Hey y'all, welcome to The Table Podcast, where we unpack questions regarding race, ethnicity, culture, norms, and current events. This is Rosemary Fajereira, and I'm going to get pretty vulnerable for this episode. I'll be using this space as a journal entry of sorts, specifically as a way for me to unpack an identity of mine that holds many emotions for me, my social class identity. In this episode, I'll be reflecting on my experiences with upward mobility as I transition from being a working-class child of immigrants to a first-generation college graduate, and now to a higher education professional. I also invited my mom, Maria Ferreira, for this episode. We've talked on this topic before in our private conversations, but I wanted to elevate my mom and her voice on this platform as well. My hope is that her words resonate for upwardly mobile children and their working class parents. So I wanted to get started with a song that, in my opinion, has gotten a little overplayed. Empire State of Mind by Jay-Z featuring Alicia Keys has become a New York City anthem. It's played during large sporting events and after the ball drops in Times Square. But in this ode to New York City, the very first words Jay-Z raps is about becoming upwardly mobile.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm up at Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere.
If you know me, you know that I'm a really proud New Yorker. That's because, like Jay-Z is rapping about in Empire State of Mind, New York made me who I am. It's in my voice, my language, the way I move, my body, and how I perceive the world. But the New York that formulated my identity isn't the glamorous one you see in Sex and the City or in Gossip Girl. It's the working class immigrant neighborhoods that I grew up in Queens and Brooklyn. My social class identity is something that I've thought about since I was a young child, even when I didn't have the language to make sense of what it was. I just knew we weren't quote-unquote normal, because normal was a house with stairs, a basement, a backyard, my own room with posters hanging on the wall. It was the big house with the giant lawn featured in shows like Seventh Heaven. I grew up instead in an old railroad-style apartment where one room opened into the other like train carts. My sister and I shared a room with no doors. We had crooked floors, and sometimes the hot water didn't work, but we never went hungry. My father has worked in bodegas or corner stores since the moment he arrived to New York from the countryside of the Dominican Republic in the 1970s. My mom, who has also immigrated from the Dominican Republic, stayed at home with us until I entered kindergarten. She then bounced around jobs for a little while before landing at a senior housing center, working as a cook and eventually being promoted to a front desk manager. Growing up, my parents worked really long hours, and my older siblings were off doing their own things, so I poured myself into school. School was a place where I felt validated and affirmed by my teachers, and I was eventually tracked into the gifted and talented classes, where I failed miserably in math, but excelled in my reading and writing. My relationship with school is something that I think about quite often because I wonder what would have happened if I sought the love and attention that I was looking for from my family elsewhere, from places that weren't as socially acceptable as school was, but was more accessible to kids like me, like the calle or the streets, as my mom consistently warned me about. I became one of those brown kids who was made fun of for, quote, acting white. According to some of my peers, reading books, raising my hand during class, and wearing Converse and Keds instead of Nikes and Jordans was considered pretty white behavior. And to be honest, I don't completely fault them because, in a way, I was trying to distance myself from them. I had internalized racism and classism and was ashamed of where I came from. I wanted to be an upper middle class white girl because I associated whiteness with good things. I wanted that girl's independence, her nice house, clothes, and good education. It was this line of thinking that pushed me to go away for college. I wanted to leave New York City and be where the white folks were. This brought me to Bard College, a small private liberal arts college in the Hudson Valley of upstate New York. Bard is a historically white college that costs over $70,000 a year, way more than what my parents ever made. I was fortunate to receive a full tuition scholarship, but took out loans to cover room and board. Once I got to Bard, I was hit with a wave of culture shock. I felt intimidated by my professors and peers. I didn't know what they were talking about as they analyzed Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis during our first year seminar. Wait, so he becomes a giant cockroach? Is all I could think to myself. The years of being told that I was a strong writer and reader by my teachers began to unravel itself, and I felt like I had been lied to. I struggled to keep up in class, and I felt ashamed of myself, so I began to close myself off from people. Things began to turn around when my academic advisor suggested I take a course entitled Postcolonial Geography. I had no idea what that even meant, but my advisor believed it would be a good course to take after I shared with him my interests in food deserts in New York City. The course was a part of the Environmental and Urban Studies department, which would eventually become my major. Studying cities, in particular my own city of New York, completely changed my life. It taught me that every single space on this earth has meaning and has a complex and delicate web of social, cultural, political, and economic histories. Learning these histories healed my deep wounds of internalized racism and classism. Learning how to love my city taught me how to love myself. And I'm so grateful for the professors who spent their time with me in their office hours offering me feedback, teaching me how to work on my outlines and drafts, and helping me to hone my voice. They pushed me to think beyond what I was ever taught, and as a result, they gifted me with a critical lens that revealed multiple deep truths about the world. It felt like they gave me the red pill, and I was seeing the Matrix, y'all. I also found community in my scholarship program, which brought together mostly low-income students of color from New York and other parts of the U.S. It was here where I learned that I was a first-generation college student, which allowed me to make sense of how being the first in my family to go to college resulted in the marginalization I felt both inside and outside of the classroom. It was also where I came to understand myself as a woman of color, an identity that holds both personal and political power. My experience in college taught me how much I was robbed of because of white supremacy and capitalism. My siblings and I were robbed of our parents' time, and our parents were robbed of their time with us, and also of their dreams. However, although I had spent the past 4 years unlearning and rebuilding my understanding about my community, I couldn't help but feel more distant. While my parents worked long, laborious hours at their jobs, I sat around wooden tables and discussed theories from scholars like Jane Jacobs and Michel Foucault. I traveled abroad to Palestine and India and developed relationships with faculty and staff members that would open a multitude of opportunities for me. After all of these years, was it too late for me to come back? Jennifer Morton is an associate professor in philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. She recently wrote a book entitled Moving Up Without Losing Your Way: The Ethical Costs of Upward Mobility. She argues that students experiencing upward mobility often have to make sacrifices in many parts of their lives, including their relationships with their family and friends, their sense of community and cultural connections, and with their own identity. These sacrifices have to be made in order to gain educational and professional opportunities that propel students into the middle and upper class. Dr. Morton suggests talking to historically marginalized students about these sacrifices rather than hiding them or avoiding them. And while I agree that we do need to hold more spaces on college campuses for first-generation and low-income students to make sense of their transitioning social class identity, the question that rises up for me is, why do we need to sacrifice ourselves, our identities, and our communities in order for us to be successful when success is tied to white middle-class norms and values that have historically hurt our communities. Instead, I dream of a world where working-class people of color don't need to pick up their pants or learn how to speak, quote, proper English, or have to hide or change any parts of who they are in order to be validated as human beings and have access to financial resources, quality housing, education, and healthcare. Unfortunately, that's not where we are as a society. The reality is that social class, especially when intersecting with race and ethnicity, dictates a lot about our lives. What I've noticed about now being a part of the professional middle class is that I have choice. I can choose to buy the more expensive brand of oat milk, and I can choose to rent a row home with updated appliances and floors where a marble can't easily roll from one side to the other. I can do these things without the heavy weight of survival on my mind. My recent move to Baltimore for my job at the University of Maryland also raises my awareness of being someone with socioeconomic privilege in a city experiencing gentrification. Gentrification is the process in which areas of a city that had been structurally disinvested in are redeveloped to meet the needs and desires of middle and upper class people. This results in working class people and their homes and businesses being displaced. I made the decision to move to a two-bedroom row home in the predominantly Latinx part of Baltimore. I'm on a block that plays ranchero, bachata, and reggaeton music out loud in speakers. Children play in the streets speaking Spanish with one another and to the adults supervising them on the stoop steps. And all of this brings me great joy. But I can also pick up that I'm on a working class block because of the trash that litters the street, the cracked and jagged sidewalk that look like broken pairs of teeth, and the lack of planted trees. I only need to walk a couple of blocks to streets near Patterson Park where it's more white and affluent, and I can immediately pick up the difference. There are tons of trees that line the street, no trash floating around, and clean, smooth sidewalks. This isn't because working class people of color are more likely to trash their own streets. It's because of a history of environmental racism and classism that denies particular areas of Baltimore the same level of resources as others. My 85-year-old neighbor, who has lived on the block for 43 years, tells me she's seen the neighborhood go through its ups and downs and is happy to see younger people like me move into the area. I'm really grateful for her kindness, but I can't help to think about how younger people who move into my neighborhood in Brooklyn aren't always aware of their socioeconomic privileges. I can't help to think about the landlords who are deliberately pushing out people like my parents by raising the rent each year. A huge wave of guilt washes over me as I think about my social position in Baltimore versus that of my neighbors and that of my parents in Brooklyn. To make sense of these feelings, I called my mom because I wanted to know what she thought about my upward mobility, especially since so much of my guilt rests in her and my father's well-being. Our conversation touches upon my upward mobility, as well as my experience in college as a first-generation student and her own experiences as an immigrant from the Dominican Republic. Hi, Mommy. Thank you so much for taking this time to talk with me.
Hi, Rosie. Yeah, it's a pleasure. it's good to talk to you always.
Thank you. It's always great to talk to you as well. We kind of already did some pre-work around this. We've talked about this a few times in the past. I've shared with you more recently around how I feel guilty about moving into my new house, especially because I know that you and Papi are still working really hard to be in New York City and afford the rent that just keeps on increasing. So I wanted to ask you, how do you feel about me getting this new job where I'm making more money and that I can afford to live in this larger house?
Well, I just feel so proud. I know I have told you this before, but yes, it's something that I know you have been working so hard for it, especially when you left home for college the first time till now. It has been a while, but now that you get this job, and I feel like you deserve it because you have been working so hard. When you are studying and struggling with all the schoolwork, and now that you are working in another jobs, and then you change for this one, and it was a surprise for us. Well, they saw all the you know, the values and all that you have been doing all these past years, so they saw in you the potential. So I'm so proud of you. Definitely. I congratulate you because that's something that really you really deserve.
Thank you, mommy. I appreciate that. And I know this isn't the first time that I've been living away from home. You talked about when I moved away for college. Was it hard for you to see me go away for school and to leave New York?
Sure. I can't accept that. I want you to come back home and your room still waiting for you. because, yeah, my home is your home. But yes, it was hard to let you go. And I struggled so hard when you told me that you want to go away because you need to live your own experiences, and that make you, that we're gonna make you grow your own personality. And that was make me feel like, yeah, okay, let me just accept that she really had to live her own experiences. And I just can't regret it because I know you have been grow actually as a great person, and you have been doing so many things that is to help the community and the people that need you. So I just still miss you a lot. And it was hard, and still hard to see you living away from home, that we cannot be together anytime when we want. But at the same time, I feel like you are mature and you can do it. You can do well. Mm-hmm. So, yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I think, you know, the reason why I asked that question is because when I read about what it means to be first to go to college, oftentimes it's for first generation students and students who come from low income backgrounds or who are people of color. They come from communities that are more focused on the collective. So on the larger community, whereas, you know, when you go to college and the college campus and has more of the dominant culture, which is predominantly white and middle class or upper class, those tend to focus more on the individual. And so for me, growing up as someone born and raised in the U.S., I thought that it was normal, you know, to go away for college. And I wanted that experience so that, like what you said, I could gain that independence. But I also know it was really hard for you. And I know it's hard for a lot of other children of immigrants, first generation students, to go away for college because their community and their family are so important to them.
Definitely. For me, it was scary because our culture, or maybe from where I come from, we always want to keep our children in the house. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to keep them with all together. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, they can go to school, but they come back home at the end of the day. But just accepting that you are going away, far away from home, for years, it was very difficult for me. Mm-hmm. And knowing that you were the younger of the family too, and that are more of my concerns. Yeah. About like maybe thinking about if you're getting sick, if you don't have somebody to help you, or not being able to be there with you, and maybe the fear that the other the friends or the people, how they're gonna treat you, if they're gonna support you or just bully you. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that, it concerns me all the time.
Yeah.
But and I know in some way you taught me that sometimes you feel the pressure from the majority. Mm-hmm. The white people, or yeah, so that made me feel very sad. Mm-hmm. And I know that you wasn't feeling well for that situation. I remember when you told me that you write in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. In the school, that you get like criticized negativity. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
About that writing that you did.
Yeah.
So I feel so scared that you can get like some kind of, that you get hurt from it, you know? But I know you are like so strong and you get over that and you keep writing over the same thing and you never stop. And that make me proud. At the end of the day, I feel just so proud of you. Like you can't, nobody stop you. Nothing stop you. So instead of making you feel down, it was the opposite. I mean, for the moment, maybe you feel like, oh, that hurts me, but you get over it and you keep moving on. And that's something to celebrate. I mean, yes. Yeah.
Did you feel like when I came back from college that I changed in any way, or do you feel like I became more distant in any way? And again, this question comes up because of research and studies where first generation students and their families, they feel like there's distance that grows, right? Because students are having this very different experience in college, which is again predominantly white, middle upper class, and so it's a very different experience from how they grew up, which is more like working class, people of color. And so it's hard for students who feel like their parents don't understand what they're going through, or their family, and vice versa, right? Like the family doesn't really understand what their children might be going through. So do you feel at all that I changed, or do you feel like there was any distance that grew between us?
Actually, I didn't feel like you changed in a bad way. Mm-hmm. But I see that you get more like mature, like you gain more independence. That was what you was looking for when you went to college. And I saw that on you. I mean, even if it's a little different now, because you are an adult and now you are ready to get a job and to move on, to move in your own place. And that way, yes, you just, I can feel like you are different now. I remember when you, and the school, the bachelor, that I told you, okay, so you're ready to come home? And you just said, no, mom, mm-hmm. I'm ready to live on my own place now. So that hurts because I'm expecting you will be back home. Mm-hmm. After 4 years. But, you know, at the same time, I feel so proud again that you are capable to do that and you want to do, I think, the good, it was a good decision for you. Yeah. So it's not like you change for in your personality or no, you keep being the same nice and gentle and
sensitive
person. That part of you never changed.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. So I know we've been talking a lot about me and my college experience, but I also wanted to hear about you. You immigrated here to the U.S. from the Dominican Republic in your early 20s, which is, you know, for me, I started college when I was 17, 18, but it was still, you know, around the same age. We both had like this kind of transition in our lives. What were your dreams or goals moving here to the U.S.? And do you feel like you were able to reach them?
When I first came here, I thought that I can continue working on the same field that I was working when I first came, when I was in Dominican Republic, because I really liked what I was doing there. But it was difficult when I came because I didn't know the language. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the chance to go to school to learn more English. So I couldn't work in the I want. Yeah, in that way I couldn't achieve what I was maybe what I want.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell more about like what you did in the Dominican Republic and what you wanted to do here?
Well, when I was high school there, I was taking classes to be a secretary. So when I graduated from high school, I graduated from the commercial school too. Mm-hmm. So I got a job and I worked there like 3 years before I came here. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought that I can keep continue doing here. But it was hard if I couldn't speak English because being a secretary means that I had to write and speak English all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I still can't do it very well.
No, you're doing a great job.
I'm sorry about it. But no. I try.
No, I need to apologize. You're doing a really great job. So do you feel like you had to, so you talked about kind of having to sacrifice this dream then of being a secretary or doing similar work in the U.S. because of the barriers, the English barrier. Are there any other sacrifices you feel like you had to make being an immigrant or being a mom of children?
Yeah. Well, months after I get married and then I start my family very early. So I just stood home for many years and I had to leave my job and I couldn't go to school at that moment because I had to be with you guys at home. Mm-hmm. And I'm so proud of it. I mean, I don't regret anything. Mm-hmm. I think that was a good time when I stayed home I take all of you to school and go to the field trips and go to all the school play, you know, being there with all of you, the three of you my children, it's something that I never regret. It makes me feel so happy that I could be, there for you guys, for you, all of you. So when I remember when you went to kindergarten, and then I started school. When you were in school, I went to my English classes, so I can start learning the language. That's how I can do it very well yet. but it's something that even if I sacrifice my career, I don't regret any of the things that I did at that time. Yeah. So now I think that when I see you or one of my children living their dream, I feel so happy for it, because I know that I couldn't do that in my early years, but now you can do it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's something to celebrate. Yeah, as a family.
Yeah, I think for me, like, I remember when I was younger, like, you were able to come to our trips, but then when I got older, you started working more. And so, like, I would come home, and then, like, it would be my older sister, Jasenia, like, she would cook for us. Like, and so, how was it then transitioning to working full time and then seeing us less and less? Because I know for me, it was hard, you know, not being able to be with you, or, you know, Poppy was also working a lot of hours. So how was it for you transitioning?
Oh, it was hard. Definitely leaving every day and not knowing what's going to happen during the day when I'm away and coming home late. And, you know, it's something that I couldn't change because of the work schedule. I cannot change. So I had to accept that it was hard for me just knowing that you guys, all of you are alone or with, you know, with my neighbor, and try to do the homework or, you know, behave well while I come back home at night every day. So it was very, very hard for me. And I know because you always tell me that it was hard for you too, that you were the younger one. Mm-hmm. And I know maybe for the older one, it was the same thing, right? Like all three of you, I guess it was hard for all of us.
Yeah.
But again, I'm so like grateful that the, you know, loneliness, you keep doing the good work at school. And yeah, I'm just so proud of it, you know, that we get through that, but we made it in a good way. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, I struggle with that because I feel like, yes, like, you know, me and my siblings, you know, we are making more money. We, you know, have our own places. You know, Jasenia has her own family. I think sometimes like the guilt comes like, but did, you know, you and Poppy make it, you know, like sometimes I feel that struggle because, you know, you guys are still working really hard. You know, Poppy works 6 days a week. You wake up really, really early to travel to the Bronx every day. Like, you know, you guys are still working so hard to survive and live in New York City, especially as the rent continues to increase and increase and increase every year. So yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, I just feel that even if we are older now, mm-hmm. and we're not young anymore, but we still can do it, you know? I mean, I guess we get used to live in this city and we used to all of this craziness of taking the trains and being on time and running around for everything. We have been doing this for so many years that, I mean, even if it's hard. It's not that easy, but we get through every day. And yeah, every day you get up and start over again. And even if it's not easy for us, like seeing everything is racing, like the rain, the everything is more expensive now. We still can manage. And even if we're not, we have some maybe health problems or issues, we still can do it. So it makes us feel like we still can be productive. So don't worry about it. One day we're just gonna get some rest.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I hope, that's what I want for you now, you know, like I want for you and Papi to be able to rest and just relax and, you know, be able to take care of yourselves without the stress. Because it is a lot. And I think that's why, you know, I tried my best to, you know, we went to the spa the other, before COVID happened, you know, I want to do my best to try to give you the experiences that, you know, now I can afford to give you, so that we can censor your rest. But I'm still not at that place where, like, I can say, Mommy, you can stop working, you know, like you can retire, like you and Papi don't need to work anymore. You know, I'm not there yet, but I wish, you know, that I could do that. And
thank you
because I do want to say, you know, you've told me how proud of you are of me this whole time, but I just want to say how proud I am of you for, you know, everything that you've been through, from, you know, immigrating from, you know, your life in the Dominican Republic to moving here, immigrating here into the U.S. and then, you know, being a mom to us and now being like a leader in your church. Like, you've done so much. And you're also a really great employee, right? Like, you do so many great things for the residents that you work with. So I just also want to share how proud I am of you. And I would not be here if it wasn't for you. But also just, I want to be who I am today if it wasn't for you and for your love.
Thank you. Thank you,
Dorothy. Of course. So I just have a couple more questions, because I know this is something we've also talked about, or you've vented to me before, where, you know, you get frustrated with working with, you know, people who, you know, are Americans, whose English is their first language, who make assumptions about you and other people who are working class immigrants. What do you wish people knew, specifically upper middle class, white folks, people with privilege? What do you wish people knew about working class immigrants?
I think that we are people with values. We are smart people too. Like, we're capable to do so many jobs that I would like them to know that we deserve the same opportunities that other people has, you know. Even if we need more school or knowledge, that doesn't mean that we cannot do the same jobs, you know. Just because we don't have maybe the school, that doesn't mean, you know, we don't deserve it. We came here with the same desire of, you know, grow up and have our family and live a better life. So we deserve to have the same opportunities.
I agree. So what would you want to say to other people who are like me, who come from working class backgrounds, went away from college, they're now making more money than their families. Sometimes maybe they might feel guilty like I do, or they feel sad or bad, or, you know, have, you know, are experiencing some heavy emotions. What would you want to say to them?
I just gonna say that instead of feeling guilty or sad, you should feel proud of yourself, because whatever you achieve, that is the product of what your family and your working family have provided for you, you know, and the support that they have given you, plus the hard work that you have been doing. So it's like, instead of feeling guilty, what I can say is just keep getting prepared, like getting the acknowledgement, or try to keep your school instead of dropping from school. Just keep working hard and looking for your goals, you know, to achieve your goals. Don't give up. Just keep going till you can get at the point where you can feel like the same way that, or you can do what you're doing now, like having your own place, you can save your money for your retirement, your early retirement, instead of working too late, you know, for longer years. So, you know, enjoying life, like travels or whatever you like. So whatever life offer you, you just have to keep working on getting there, getting to that, you know, place where you can now work and get a better job. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so better opportunity. Mm-hmm. So just keep going to school. Don't give up.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. So, I mean, I think what's so valuable that I want to highlight from our conversation is that while, yes, it's difficult, you know, for, you know, children who are becoming upwardly mobile to go from being in a community-based culture to an individual based culture, like, I think it's important for us to remember that, you know, us achieving our goals is us achieving our goals for the whole family, right? That, yes. Like, yes. Me, you know, getting this job, graduating with my bachelor's and my master's, getting this new home that I'm in, that I never imagined, that I used to dream of a house like this. I never thought I could actually live in one now. You know, that all of this isn't just me, right? Like, this is also your dreams and your goals that I get to now live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. I think all you are celebrating now is for the whole family, including the extended family, like my sibling. I mean, they all feel proud of you too. And it's I think that's something to celebrate for all of us. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I think for all the work class,
yeah,
families, when one of our children achieve what you have achieved, is something to celebrate all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. Because maybe for us, we don't have the chance to get prepared or to go to college in our early years. Mm-hmm. But we can support our children to do it, and they can do the other part. That is the hard work and studying and all of the a part of it. So at the end, we all can have our goal.
Yeah.
Achieve goals. Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's all of us need to feel proud of it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you so much. And I love you very much.
Thank you, Rosie. You know that I love you more.
For my fellow Upperly Mobile first-generation college graduates who also come from working-class immigrant backgrounds, I hope that there are two things you get from this episode. One, if you experience guilt as I do, it is because we grew up in collectivist cultures where we care deeply about our family and our communities. Remember that our achievements as individuals are achievements for our family and our whole community. So what can leaning into that collective joy and abundance look like for us? Two, recognize and reflect on your newfound class privilege. While many of us are likely not part of a billionaire class, we do now hold some level of access and power over others in our society, so it's important to critically think about the ways that our privilege shows up in our bias. The more we openly discuss our social class identity, the more we can raise our class consciousness and build solidarity with folks who are the most marginalized. Thank you so much for listening.
The Table is a production of the Intercultural Center and the Division of Student Affairs at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. It's hosted and produced by Courtney Jones Carney and Rosemary Ferreira. This episode was also written by Rosemary. The show's executive producer and editor is me, Angela Jackson, Senior Marketing Specialist in the Division of Student Affairs. A big thank you to today's guest, Rosemary's wonderful mom, Maria Ferreira, for helping Rosemary tell her story and for joining us at the table. For more information about the Intercultural Center, including events where students can learn more about race, ethnicity, culture, norms, and current events, visit umaryland.edu/ILE. Thanks for listening. See you next time.